This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
And greetings. Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and today's big picture, which is actually this week's big picture. You know, in the last 2 weeks, if you've been following the show, we did a series of 7 mega trends, which we believe will be radically changing the world you live in and will be impacting us over the next decade. 3 of those mega trends actually appeared in the news either this week and last weekend. One of those was the one we entitled Automation and the Death of Routine Jobs. It was an article, actually a cover article of Barron's magazine, all about robots and automation. We're not going to recover that topic. You can either pick up a copy of Barron's or listen to the shows that we did that are archived here in the last couple of weeks on this subject of the mega trends. One was Orwell's World. Ironically, this isn't a left or right versus issue. It seems like both Republicans and Democrats, when it suited them, have rushed to try to end run the Constitution and do certain things that increase, I guess, what you'd call totalitarian snooping or other activities on the part of government. Surprise, surprise, another major WikiLeaks dump this week, which shows that Americans could be in the process of being spied on by government agencies, notably the CIA, which theoretically, legally isn't supposed to happen. But they can use your smart television, if you have one, a smart TV at home with cameras built into it, computers, or smartphones. They can literally take anything with a camera and a microphone and use it as a listening or watching device. If you remember back in George Orwell's 1984, that's what they were doing. All societies that are powerful enough to give you everything you want are big enough to take everything you have in order to do it. And we did get some emails from people. Every time we do this, Jim, we have people say, well, it's getting a little political. You shouldn't do that. And we always point out you cannot separate the politics from the economics because government policy and the level of freedoms that it allows actually determine what the economics are going to look like. That. Remember, Hernán de Soto did a book. He lives in Peru, and he did a book entitled Why Capitalism Succeeds in the West and Fails Everywhere Else. And he was talking about that, Jim. It's the legal structure which either allows the free market to function or which chokes it to death. So you cannot separate economics and politics. It's impossible to do it. And that's what's happening whenever a Congress or a presidential administration says they're going to make tax and regulatory policy. That has a direct impact upon what's going on in the investment area. The third megatrend that popped up, this is interesting because there's a radical shift in education as people are moving away from traditional education. You see that in the charter schools, you see it in homeschools, private schooling, but also in the area of post-high school education. The complaint among a lot of millennials now is they spent, you know, they have $100,000 in debt, which is a flabbergasted amount that theoretically they were supposed to be able to get a real good job, and they invested in it, graduated from college, got the degree and or degrees, and now they can't find a job. And so we entitled that one Education Technology in the Age of Guilt. Say, for example, there is a company out there called Praxis, where they take people such as high school graduates, put them through a boot camp, which lasts X amount of time, and an apprenticeship in areas of high tech, and they get them a job within 9 months. No degree required or other special training other than what they're given in this program. And they're being trained for high tech positions because remember, if manufacturing is more and more being done by robots, there are going to be people that have to watch the robots and to maintain the computer systems and the automation that accomplishes that, not to mention maintenance on the robots. Now, that's a whole different field of specialization than what workers would do putting things together in manufacturing before. It has a specific skill set which is required. And just to show you what we're talking about, here's an audio clip from the Praxis site to show you what it is they're doing.
How to go from student to startup in just 9 months. You don't need to sit in more classrooms or blast out resumes or go through years of training. You can start today. Praxis combines a 3-month professional boot camp with a 6-month paid apprenticeship at a startup that leads directly to a full-time job. And startups aren't just for coders. sales, marketing, operations, even if you're not sure what you're interested in, Praxis places you with a dynamic, growing company where you get paid to do work you love, become part of a team, and learn to create value. It's not just an internship, it's real work. In addition to the apprenticeship, you complete an intensive education program that combines professional development training, skill-building projects, and one-on-one coaching. You'll leave the program with a full-time job offer and the skills and experiences you need to write your own ticket to any company you want to work for, or even start your own. No degree is required to get started on your career. Whether you're an ambitious go-getter right out of high school, a creative thinker who's bored in college, or a college grad looking for something better than more school or a cubicle job, discover Praxis. The world is waiting. Are you ready?
Yeah, and by the way, we didn't get paid anything to run that particular ad, but it gives you an idea of the new thrust of direction where education is heading, because there are a lot of people who are dropping out of the workforce in low-paid jobs. This is a whole different approach, saying we will specifically train people for specific types of technology jobs and get them ready within X amount of months, and they'll get a job that decently pays.
Yeah, I mean, this is exactly what the NIBR study talked about when it talked about this automation trend that's taking place, where a lot of these lower skilled jobs are going to be replaced by robots and machines. They're going to be automated in artificial intelligence. Here's a company that puts an individual, just take an individual out of high school. They go through this 3-month intense training program, 6 months on the job apprenticeship where they're actually getting paid for the job. And then at the end of that 6 months, 9 months, they place them in a highly skilled job where they're making good money. You contrast that, John, to 4 years of college education, which may set you back $100,000 in debt or more, depending on where you're getting your education. And you take a look at the class of 2015, only 15% of the graduating students had meaningful jobs. So this is more and more of what this mega trend that we're talking about. The internet and companies like this are going to do to brick and mortar schools what the internet has done to brick and mortar retailers. And so this is coming. And this is a good example of that trend that we were talking about. But it was amazing that we've seen these developments come out within a week or this week from the time that we first did this show 2 weeks ago in last weekend.
Okay, so we've talked about 7 megatrends, and there were several we mentioned when we started doing this 7 megatrend series that we thought were a lot bigger and a lot more significant. They're all significant, but as far as total impact than these 7, and what we really thought is that they deserved, each of them, a show of their own. So today we're covering one of them. And by the way, on the Praxis idea, this is really just a 21st century idea of a medieval practice. Praxis meaning practice. It's a Latin-based word where in the medieval times during the early Renaissance, they had guilds where people were trained and then apprenticed to move into a particular field of occupation. That's what's happening all over again here. Anyway, what is the trend we're talking about today? What's the emphasis, Jim?
Okay, we're calling this the next big thing, and the trend is infrastructure. And John, this is a major significant mega trend that will last well beyond a decade. And it's going to drive economic growth. It's going to drive investment growth. It's going to drive stock market growth. I mean, this is a big one, which is why that we have wanted to kind of save this and give it its own special highlight, which is what we're going to do on today's show. Now, let me put this into perspective. For the last 8 years, coming out of the Great Recession, much of economic growth has been driven by economic policy, and it's proven to be less effective. I mean, when we talk about economic growth, we've averaged about 2.1% versus 3-4%. It's been the worst economic recovery since World War II. And what we're seeing now, as a result of the, let's say, the efficacy of monetary policy has been declining, we are going to see a paradigm shift that's coming that is going to be global in nature. It's taking place already overseas in Asia. It's taking place in Latin America, and it's a major subject of the 2016 election. One of the main points that Trump brought up in his campaign was, we need to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure. And we're going to get into that in terms of how it applies here. And then also talk about the implications where it is accelerating and is even a bigger trend when you look at overseas. And one of the reasons why this is coming to the forefront is, in other words, not only the lack of efficacy of monetary policy, but it's also central banks realizing that they've been squawking over the last couple of years in front of Congress and say, hey, we can't do this all by ourselves. We can only cut interest rates so far. We need something to stimulate the economy. So we're talking about Keynesian style stimulus. Keynesian style stimulus could be a waste of money. However, when you take stimulus and it's used to apply to infrastructure, there's a multiplier effect that has a positive effect on economic growth, tax revenues, and investment. So if the government is going to spend money, this is the best way they can do it, because this is what drives the economy. Now, one of the reasons that a lot of adherence to this particular trend is people are saying, look, we're looking at the lowest interest rates in 5,000 years of recorded history. And we know that part of this spending on fiscal infrastructure is going to have to be financed. And so this is the ideal time to finance. Think of yourself, if you own a home, think of what you have been able to get a mortgage, a 30-year mortgage or a 15-year mortgage or 10-year mortgage, what you've been able to get that mortgage, the cost of financing that mortgage and buying a house these last 3 or 4 years. The same thing. We've seen businesses refinance all their debt. And now the impetus to do this is, look, take advantage while interest rates are low to finance this. And this trend is so big that it is going to, I mean, the total figure of infrastructure spending, you know, Trump's talking about $1 trillion. We actually need to spend more. That's just doing the minimum. The total dollars allocated to infrastructure spending over the next decade are going to amount, John, to $26 trillion. According to Bloomberg Intelligence, they calculate that infrastructure investment will rise at an annual rate of 7.8% over the next 10 years, mounting to $26 trillion over the next 10 years.
What do you think are some of the drivers that are behind this?
At the top of the list, a big one when it comes to energy is climate change. A second driver is the breakneck pace that we're seeing in urbanization, and particularly in two populous countries like India and China. We're seeing also increasing population density in major megacities. I'm trying to think where I recalled the number. The number of cities in China that have a population of over 1 million people. Also, straining transit networks from power supplies and aviation. And it's something that is global because we live in a global world today. You take a look at supply chains. You may have a factory in Peoria that gets its parts and are assembly different parts of whatever product they make, whether it's a tractor, a television, or whatever it is. You may have the supply chain come from Brazil, from Australia, parts made in South Korea, Singapore, China, and then eventually assembled. There's a company here that I know the original owners. It's a fitness equipment company. A lot of the design is done here, but the pre-manufactured parts are made in China, and then they're shipped here and is assembled in a factory. So we're a global economy today, and infrastructure is what drives economic growth and drives that economy.
Well, remember, I mean, I guess we could zoom it all the way back to the 1930s when FDR did all of the infrastructure spending as part of his spaghetti alphabet soup New Deal. But if we come forward to modern times here, when President George W. Bush came into office, remember that we were in a recession, and they talked at the time about infrastructure spending as a way of stimulating the economy, giving people jobs, kicking money into there. Now, the same thing also happened during President Obama's administration. They sort of tried it, but it didn't work. So why would it work now? It's what President Trump is talking about as well. And we've got to do it. I mean, there's some things that really need to be repaired.
Well, you know, and the problem with politicians is they're looking for short-term impact. So we know that Congress has to run for re-election every 2 years and one-third of the Senate. So politicians are looking for something they can point to. Ah, look what we did. And it is much easier to, for example, talk about a tax cut or a new entitlement like Obamacare or social benefits because people can see them right away. The problem with something like an infrastructure spending bill, it may take 2 or 3 years before the money that is allocated actually gets spent in the economy. And that's one of the things that happened to Obama. He appropriated in his stimulus bill $48 billion for infrastructure in 2009. By the year 2012, only three quarters of that ever actually got spent. There was also a thing that came into play with, especially because of the misallocation of funds with the stimulus bill that came in with Obama, is that all of a sudden we had these trillion-dollar deficits. And so all of a sudden Congress was fixated on controlling the debt from $1.5 trillion and trillion-dollar deficits. Don't forget, in 8 years, Obama ran up a deficit of $10 trillion. He doubled the national debt, just like his predecessor, George W. Bush, doubled the national debt from $5 trillion to $10 trillion. Obama took it from $10 trillion to $20 trillion. So we had the sequester. We had all this emphasis on reducing deficits. So that was part of the issue. And then also, the other thing that has happened, and we'll get into this as we further explore this mega trend, is it takes now, it has gone from 5 to 10 years to get a shovel-ready project implemented unless you get a congressional law or waiver or presidential waiver, just as, for example, President Trump did with executive order on two pipelines. And then there's also a lot of critics right now that are saying, well, we're too late in the business cycle. The labor market is real tight, and everything with politicians is short-term. And we know that one of the issues is it takes 5 to 10 years to get a project through and implemented. And we'll get more into detail on that and what I think are going to be some major legislative changes and executive orders that are going to come about. But we're going to need a crisis first before this gets accelerated. That's why I think infrastructure spending is a 2019-2020 issue versus a 2017 or a 2018 issue, unless you're looking overseas where infrastructure spending is accelerating. We'll get into that later on. But of course, the one thing that they're talking about, and we addressed this a couple of weeks ago with my guest Gary Schilling, is when you want to talk about stimulating the economy, helicopter drops. One way that Trump is talking about is a public-private partnership where part of the cost of infrastructure will be funded by the private sector. And then also through the public sector, you might talk about, you know, the government issues the bonds and the Fed prints the money and buys the bonds. So it's another method of helicopter drop. And this is another megatrend paradigm shift that we'll talk in a separate program as well.
You know, it's curious you bring this up. I was just reading before we started to do the show an article in USA Today about West Virginia showing a bridge that was partially completed because the funds had run out. And saying, well, President Trump promised to bring jobs back and everything else, but voila, it's not happening. And I thought, jeepers, it's only been a month and a half, you know? And here you're saying that it takes several years to do this, but what would it take to accomplish the same thing? Because it seems like it's happening overseas. What would it take to make it happen here?
There are a number of things that are going to have to be done. Number one, you're going to have to prioritize and have favorable project selection. In other words, when you come in and you want to spend $1 trillion or whatever the final number turns out to be, you are going to have an advance. You're going to have to select projects. All right, we're going to spend $1 trillion, $100 billion a year. Here's what we're going after first. We're going to fix this. We're going to fix this. And we'll get into a new report that just came out by America's Society of Engineers. They issue a report every 4 years. The last one was 2013. And their new report just got issued this week. But you need favorable project selection. Two, you have to see efficiency of implementation. You cannot have this caught up in lawsuits for 5 or 10 years. Three, you have to have a source of financing. And four, you've got to cut through the environmental regulations and the bureaucratic red tape, which can bog down a project for 10, 15 years. There was a bridge that just recently got fixed. It was in danger of collapsing, John, and it took 16 years to work through the lawsuits and all the regulation to get it fixed. And we're going to talk about some of that. But in addition, one of the reasons you're going to have a crisis evolve, because right now the Fed is in a tightening mode and we expect them to raise interest rates next week when they meet. We expect they'll probably raise interest rates in June, and we expect possible another rate increase in, let's say, maybe December. So this is going to raise the cost of financing. We also know that every time the Fed does this, they end up breaking something, and it's usually the economy. But on one hand, if we get another recession, which I think is likely, what happens in a recession? Congress critters finally act. It always takes a crisis to move these guys to do something. Otherwise, they'll spend playing politics, delays, and all the kind of things that you're seeing going on in Washington right now. But this week, there was a report that came out. It is the 2017 report that's put out by America's Society of Civil Engineers. It's hot off the press. It came out on Thursday. It's called Failure to Act, Closing the Infrastructure Investment Gap for America's Economic Future. And John, let's go to that clip from the American Society of Engineers.
Infrastructure is important to everybody.
And that infrastructure is supporting our daily lives.
It's a huge economic driver for every region in the country that's investing in infrastructure.
The American Society of Civil Engineers provides a way to determine what the quality of our infrastructure is. And we do that by producing a report card every 4 years. The 2017 ASCE Infrastructure Report Card overall grade is a D+. So what does that mean? The grades that go up, it's because we, either at the federal level, state level, or municipal level, are putting money into that sector.
Well, good infrastructure allows us to be more competitive in the world. And for example, we know work we've done shows that if we don't have a competitive infrastructure, it will cost this economy $3.9 trillion in our gross domestic product. That's the equivalent of the GDP of Germany.
Infrastructure is absolutely critical to the ability of manufacturers to compete and succeed. And so for every dollar that is invested in manufacturing, another $1.81 of economic output occurs from a position of economic strength. I don't think we have the option of failing to address our infrastructure challenges.
The 16 categories that we grade, while they are individual categories, do point to the fact, though, that our infrastructure is all tied together and that those 16 categories are tied together. So while we might invest a lot of money, for example, in water systems, if we fail to invest in the energy grid, the water system will not likely be able to perform as expected.
In some areas, we are investing.
The freight railroad system in the United States is second to none. And the reason it is second to none is because of its continued investment so that it meets the needs of today and puts us in a position to meet the needs of tomorrow.
So there you have that opening clip. That new report is out, and it couldn't come out at a better time when the country, the president, is talking about investing in infrastructure. It's amazing. They started doing these reports going back to 1998, and when they did the first report, the average for the U.S. was D. And this year's report, the one that just came out this week, is D+. And so really what they're talking about here is the future of our economy is at stake, because infrastructure is the backbone of any economy. It's deteriorating, and it is also evolving into a public safety issue. And we'll talk about some recent examples of this. And unfortunately, sometimes, John, it takes something like a tragedy. We saw this with the breaking of the levees with Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in New Orleans. And it's amazing. When they did the 2013 report, The funding gap for infrastructure was $3.6 trillion. Fast forward to 2017, and now that infrastructure gap is $4.3 trillion. So it's gone up $700 billion, and it is just absolutely, it's getting worse and worse. And so, you know, some of the states have been making inroads and trying to improve infrastructure, but we're falling further and further behind, and it jeopardizes the well-being of the economy, the efficiency, the cost. There's all kinds of things associated with this.
Well, of course, infrastructure makes everything go. What drives the economy is business, and then what drives business are households that are out there. So what are the impacts then on this whole perspective about an infrastructure that gets a D+?
Well, they talked about the impact on business, and you just think about it. Increased costs of production, for example, the cost of electricity, water, wastewater, intermediate goods for production from surface transportation, as well as costs associated with electricity, water, and wastewater for, let's say, making and purchasing products. I mean, think about what goes into a factory. It's not only just electricity, it's raw materials, it's transportation. Declining exports as the cost of production increases, making them more expensive. Increased cost of business travel with poor surface transportation, inefficiencies at airports, and declining consumer spending. I don't know what it's like you, John. We just went through rains here, but our streets are just marked with potholes where you really have to watch where you're driving. I've basically bent a rim by hitting a pothole. You've had increasing cases, John, what do you call those things where all of a sudden the road caves in and it's this huge cavernous hole?
Yeah, sinkholes as opposed to potholes. Hey, listen, let me tell you, it's not any better. I'm doing the show from Chicago tonight, and I just drove from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho to Chicago this week, and we spent the entire trip on the freeway dodging potholes.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is very, very expensive, and they try to put this into perspective, and they said, all right, in their conclusions, what is this going to cost? Well, if you take a look at the cumulative effect from 2016 to 2025, business sales, $7 trillion, GDP, $4 trillion, from 2026 to 2040, almost $29 trillion in business sales, $14 trillion in GDP. What does this mean on the job front? By 2025, a loss of 2.5 million jobs. By 2040, 5.8 million jobs. Breaking it down to what does it cost a consumer? $3,400 per year in additional costs. So you can see where this is really having an impact. You know, you can see it if you live in Southern California or along the coast in California, you could get bogged down in traffic. I mean, John, it's gotten so bad when I have business appointments, let's say in Orange County or Los Angeles, I usually go up the night before because I cannot take a risk of being caught on the freeway. I remember once I had to go up to a business meeting. It was up in Los Angeles, and I left the house on Sunday, and there was a breakdown. There were accidents, and there were various things and construction. It took me 4 hours to go about 90 miles on the freeway. So think of what that does during the weekend transportation. If you've got trucks that need to go from a port in San Diego or Los Angeles to San Francisco or inland because goods have to be transported. So you can see the cumulative effect of all of this. I'll tell you, this report by American Society of Civil Engineers couldn't come out at a more inopportune time. But unfortunately, I think it's going to take another recession, and it's going to take something that happens more serious to motivate our Congress critters to actually get something done.
Yeah, and the real question is are we going to do something about this before something really bad happens? Because we're seeing more and more examples of this. You know, we hear stories of bridges collapsing or being on the verge of collapsing or very inferior structure when they're examined because they've decayed so much, they've rusted out. We recently had the dam in Oroville, California, where the spillway began to erode, and had that given way, it would have caused major flooding. Remember, they had to evacuate a bunch of people from there. So we see this everywhere. And the real question is, sort of like the Federal Reserve, are they just going to dilly-dally on it until something breaks? Or are they going to try to be proactive about it?
Well, I mean, the president wants to be proactive, but, you know, once again, he can propose, but Congress dispose. So the real question is, can he get this through Congress? Now, if there's one thing that both parties agree on, Democrats oppose the president's tax cuts. So there's going to be a battle there. But they both agree on infrastructure. So maybe there's probably more hope. The problem is the delays of actually legislating something, getting it approved, signed by the president, to the time, a lot of these infrastructure projects are actually implemented at the state level. But that's why I want to move on to the global cost of infrastructure, because that's where we're seeing the greatest progress. India and China are spending huge amounts. Infrastructure spending in China is growing at 18% a year. They're going to be spending on everything in China, from water treatment, sewage, pollution, clean energy, hospitals, and schools. India is going to build 55,000 miles of roads. And so Asia Pacific is going to account for almost 60% of all infrastructure spending in the next decade. So when you take that $26 trillion figure, 60% of that is going to be spent in Asia. If you look at Asia Pacific, it'll account for almost 43% of all wind investments. And so, John, where things are getting implemented fast at the, let's say, the fastest pace, because they don't have to go through all the environmental BS that we have here, is probably Asia and Latin America, where you're seeing vast amounts of money that are being spent. And there's so much money, as Bloomberg talked about, Bloomberg Intelligence, infrastructure spending is going to grow at almost 8% a year, this $26 trillion.
What does this lack of infrastructure right now, I guess, mean for you or for the average individual?
Well, I mean, if we take a look at our transportation system, poor roads and airports, what does that mean? Increased travel time delays at airports, congestion on traffic on freeways. If you take a look at the aging electric grid and inadequate water, it makes utilities more unreliable. A good example is my own state of California. Here in San Diego alone, since 2000, utilities, the cost of electric power has gone up 700%. It's up 70%. In the last 3 years, higher cost means it costs more for businesses to manufacture and distribute, which is why a lot of companies are closing down their factories here in California. They're moving elsewhere. It's just too expensive. We got congested freeways, so you have to put something on a truck and get it somewhere. It takes a longer period of time. Now, what was interesting is that when you put this down, what does this mean? When they boiled down and they summarized their report on infrastructure, it's going to cost us almost $4 trillion in lost GDP by the year 2025. It's going to cost business $7 trillion in lost sales, lost jobs of 2.5 million, and per family, annual cost of $3,400 per year. Now, let's take a look at where this money needs to be spent. If you take a look at our infrastructure needs, the electric grid is right now 81% funded. It lacks funding of $177 billion. If you take a look at our waterways, they're 59% funded. That will take $15 billion. Our water systems, sewage, 30% funded. That's going to require $105 billion. And the big one is roads and bridges, which are only 46% funded, requiring additional expenditures of $1.1 trillion. Airports, 73% funded, requiring an additional $4.2 billion. All of this adding up to approximately $4.3 trillion. And what they're talking about, the implications are a decade of slowing economic growth ahead as a result of demographics. And this is taking place here in the U.S., Europe, and Asia, and Latin America. So once again, this infrastructure megatrend is global in scope. The greatest percentage will be in Asia Pacific, which will account for almost 60% of those expenditures.
what we probably need to do now is look at the problems of implementing this, assuming we can get Congress to put things through. What are the hoops we'd have to go over?
Well, a lot of it is just bureaucratic red tape. I mean, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently called Speed Limits on Trump's Infrastructure Drive, Federal Laws, Rare Species, and NIMBYs. And they opened up the article talking about a 6-mile stretch of freeway in California between South Pasadena and Alhambra. John, this has been caught up in the courts for 60 years. 60 years. The Oroville Dam, which recently made the news with the California flooding situation, what they never told you about the Oroville Dam, there were supposed to be two dams that were built. They built the Oroville Dam, but there was supposed to be another dam that was built above the Oroville Dam that would help mitigate some of the flooding that comes down from the mountains when you get drenched, as we get with some of these downpours that we've seen here in the last 6 weeks. The problem is, the second dam never got built due to environmental restrictions. I mentioned that Obama appropriated $48 billion for infrastructure projects. Only $33 billion got spent by 2012. And here's the thing, that the cost to get a project and the time delays has gone from 5 years to 10 years. The Army Corps of Engineers wanted to dredge a harbor in Savannah. It took them 16 years to get it approved. And one of the main reasons is we had three major pieces of legislation that have come in on the environmental side. The first was called the National Historic Preservation Act. That took place in 1966. Then we had the National Environment Policy Act, and that was in 1970. And then finally, the Endangered Species Act in 1973. Now, NEPA, which is NEPA, that's the National Environmental Policy, is embedded in every single infrastructure project. In fact, the U.S. government has almost 100 NEPA lawsuits every single year. And unfortunately, John, we've gone from NIMBY, not in my backyard, to banana, which is build absolutely nothing anytime near anybody. And so what it's going to take to implement this is congressional action, because the one bridge that was in danger of collapsing took congressional approval to bypass all these various acts so they could get it done. Otherwise, the doggone thing was in danger of collapsing, and it would stop major traffic that would hamper the economy of two different cities. So anyway, we think, as you look at this, even with presidential action, even with legislative action on part of Congress, I really think the infrastructure story is more of a 2019-2020 story after a recession in the U.S.
From an investment standpoint, if we look at this where it is and where we know it needs to go, depending on how long it takes to get there, how are you playing this from an investment standpoint?
Well, I mean, as I mentioned, the total figure for infrastructure is $26 trillion. 60% of that is going to be in Asia. The bulk of this infrastructure is going to be taking place outside the United States, where they're not hamstrung by environmental regulations. So we're looking at this from two ways that you can play it. One is going to be commodities. When you start spending money on infrastructure, that's more steel, that's more cement, that's more copper. So commodities is one way to play it. And we could see if, as this takes place, another bull market develop in commodities in the next decade. The second is we're looking at companies that make the equipment, companies that provide the service, utilities, and also engineering firms. And so the firms that are international in scope are more of what we're finding in our research, because the bulk of this infrastructure spending is going to take place outside the United States. So you want a company that has an international presence that can take advantage of this. But so we're looking at playing this from two sides, one from the commodity side and then also from the company side, whether it's equipment, service, utilities, or engineering.
And what we're saying here in this whole segment is that as a megatrend, infrastructure is global in scope. It's going to play out in virtually every country in the world. It will be one of the top megatrend agendas coming out of Washington with vast implications for investment. And so keep that in mind as we move forward into the future.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
I think that there's definitely been a positive shift. The question, though, is the sustainability of the shift and how that shift is translating into actual spending, actual economic activity, because we know the sentiment's high. I mean, we can look at any data point out there, consumer sentiment, you know, pick your poison. Everyone feels positive versus where they were, say, in the October timeframe. And it's fair to say when people feel more positive, when the sentiment is going up, you hope that that's going to somehow convert into actual spending. And that's kind of where the problems are, is if you're in the stock market, you know, it's gotten way, way ahead of itself. And so what happens next is probably going to be something akin to a little bit of a blow off.
Welcome back to The Big Picture. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. Next week, the Fed will meet for the second time this year. Of course, I'm sure you know by now, it is widely expected they will raise interest rates, taking the federal funds rate to 1%. This will be the third hike within the course of a year. The president wants to stimulate the economy right now. He understands that you have to do that to get jobs going, versus the opposite opinion that we need to slow things down. That would be Janet Yellen's position, the chair of the Fed. Unfortunately, the Fed right now can't argue that we have high inflation, because we don't. They can't argue that the economy is overheating and they need to slow things down at a jobs rate hovering around 1%. That simply isn't true. So you have to ask yourself, just what is it these guys are doing? And are they going to follow that age-old tried-and-true method that the Federal Reserve uses, raise the rates and wait until something breaks, and then you know you've gone too far?
Well, given its track record over the last 60, 70 years, that's exactly what they're probably going to do. And it's amazing if you read through the text of the things that they say, the fine print, basically what they're saying is, look, we want to normalize monetary policy. We don't like it when we're down here at a quarter of a point or a half a point. We'd like to raise it so then we can lower it. Remember that skit that we played from The Office where a guy's talking about, you know, I can raise my cholesterol at will. And somebody said, well, why would you want to do that? So I can lower it again. And so I think that explains what they're doing. But currently, if you look at Fed futures, it's all but pricing almost a 90-something percent probability they go next week. That will be the third rate hike, which we get as I talked with Craig Johnson in hour one on the three steps and a stumble routine. Every time the Fed raises after the third rate hike, you see a little bit of deceleration in terms of what happens to the market. Although Craig thinks that that's a story for probably 2018, I did notice that now that we've hit 2350 on the S&P, his target of 2424 for the rest of the year is not as great as his previous projections. So I think that takes into account these coming rate hikes. But if you look at the futures market, the futures market is pricing in a rate hike in March, a rate hike in June, and probably another one coming in December, which would take the Fed funds rate to 1.5%. And one of the things our technicians have been talking about, and we've had several here on the program, they think that the 10-year treasury can get to 3% or more. Craig thinks it could get to maybe 3.25%. And so this old adage, the Edson Gould adage, the three steps and a stumble, should start to have some impact on the markets, although Craig still thinks that the markets are still heading higher by year end. Now, looking back at history, what is interesting to note is after a third rate hike, the stock market tends to underperform, and market performance is usually worse after the rate hikes than before them. So it's hard to argue that it doesn't have some kind of impact on performance. And I think that's one of the reasons that Craig is probably a little bit more circumspect, because he's one of the most bullish technicians. He's a CFA and a CMT, so he's both technical and fundamental, but he's probably less bullish as he has been in the past. I think a lot of that reflects what's going on with the Fed. And you have to remember, when the Fed first announced this, and this began in May of 2013, when they said, look, they were printing $80 billion a month. Basically, that was the taper tantrum. And they took about a year to phase it out. And then they began raising rates in 15. They raised it once. They raised it once in 16. Now they're saying, hey, pedal to the metal, we are going to really start to accelerate those rate hikes. When the December rate hike, they said, we're increasing our projections for rate hikes in 2017 to 3 times instead of previously, it was 2 times. And so we are now starting to see this rate hike, or what we call the kill cycle, begin to accelerate, and it should have some impact on stock market performance. And it's no surprise that we've seen the stock market sort of consolidate or sort of stall here instead of that huge upsurge that we saw coming out of the November 8th elections.
Yeah, but I guess that brings me back to my original statement here. The claim is that they want to, quote, normalize the monetary policy right now. But you have to look at it. The inflation is less than 2%. Growth is certainly less than 2%. So you can't say that's in runaway situation. There are no high levels of inflation and no imbalances to speak of. So do they really understand what they're doing, or do they have a different motivation?
A lot of these guys are academics. They're saying, gosh, we've been in this low monetary environment for almost 8 years now, and we'd like to normalize it. But in the process of normalizing it, they're going to create the next recession, which is what they always do. And the other thing I would point out is most of the inflationary increases that we've seen recently have been mainly in the energy sector. When we saw oil last year from hitting a low of $26 a barrel, going all the way to over $50 a barrel. So a lot of this impact has come from the oil sector. However, if we take a look at history, we have had, in the last 60 years, we have had 8 recessions. And I want to point out, the Fed failed to forecast every one of them. We've had 11 recessions since World War II, and every one of those 11 recessions were preceded, every single one of them, by a rate-raising cycle. There's an old adage on Wall Street that says economic cycles do not die of old age, but usually are murdered. And basically, the assassin here is the Federal Reserve. You see this mistake repeated in every single cycle. Towards the end of a business cycle, the economy starts to overheat. We haven't seen it yet because we're barely cruising along at 2%. As that happens, you start to see inflation pick up. And so the Fed keeps raising rates, putting its foot on the brakes and the brakes and brakes until finally the car comes to a complete standstill and you're in a recession. And they do it as a late cycle response to inflation. So, John, in my estimation, they're going to make the same mistake. These are guys that come out of the academic world. None of these people have worked in the private sector. They don't really understand. They have a lot of models that are flawed, which is why their forecasts are wrong 95% of the time. They have yet to forecast a recession. The other thing is, none of these guys have ever operated on a trading desk, so they don't fully understand. Although, if you take a look at the last 2 years, one of the things I think have held them back, especially last year, where they were predicting raising rates 4 times, was what happened to the stock market in the first couple months of the year, where they had to backtrack from their original estimates.
You know, when we talk about doing things until things break, what would be the classic signs that we are getting to the end of a cycle, or actually to a recession?
Well, one of the classic signs of a tight monetary policy, and it has a fairly decent track record of predicting recessions, is an inverted yield curve, meaning short-term interest rates are higher than long-term interest rates. Short-term interest rates are higher because the Fed is raising those short-term rates. Long-term rates are lower because they're capped, because investors begin to anticipate a recession. Money starts flowing into bonds, suppressing the yield. And this is one of the things that you'll see as we begin to raise interest rates here, we are creating a cavernous spread between what interest rates pay here in the U.S. and what they are overseas, where some of the rates are still negative if you're looking at Europe and Japan. So what happens? Money's going to seek the grounds of where it's treated best. So if rates are higher here, investors, that's going to bring in foreign capital, especially since central banks in Europe and Japan are still in the quantitative easing mode. If you take a look at these interest rate spreads, that will cap long-term rates. Also, as investors begin to anticipate a slowdown in economic growth and the possibility of a recession, you will also see that money will start flowing into the bond market. It's kind of like the risk on and the risk off trade, where you see money flow out of stocks and you see money flow into bonds as a safe haven to ride out a recession. And it's amazing, just taking a look at the Fed's forecasting track record, whether you go back to the recession of August 1957, where they're saying things were looking pretty rosy, what actually happened to GDP, it contracted by 3.2% in the following 12 months. They did the same thing in 1960, where they said the expansion is growing robustly. Four quarters later, they were basically down by 2.3%, and I could go on and on. They did the same thing in 1969. We had a recession. They did the same thing in 73. We had a big recession. The economy contracted by 5%. They did it again in 1981, 1990, March of 2001, and December of 2007. In other words, they have failed to predict every single recession. I don't think they're going to change. They operate with flawed economic models, so that's part of the problems that we have. What we do know right now is stimulus is coming. It'll probably come first in the way of tax cuts. The infrastructure that we talked about in the megatrends in BP1, I think that's going to be a 2019 story and 2020 story, and it will come following a recession. So right now, the Fed is hell-bent on raising interest rates. And once again, with no experience in the private sector, with flawed economic models, and never worked on the trade desk, they will continue to make the same repeated mistakes. The Fed is always looking in the rearview mirror instead of looking on the road in front of them.
So we have the Fed meeting next week and the probability of what, a June or December rate hike? How would that affect the markets, or anything you think is going to spook the markets next week?
Well, there is one thing that could spook the markets. I mean, the markets have priced in a coming rate hike, and it's one of the reasons why I think you've seen stocks stumble here in the last couple of weeks, as it's become more pronounced and the probabilities have increased of that rate hike coming next week. If they raise the dot plot, which is Fed governors' future projections of where they think interest rates are going to be this year and next year, if that dot plot goes up, that could be something that really spooks the market. Other than that, John, right now the market has already priced in the March rate hike. And now after March, we'll start talking about what are they going to do? When will they go next? They have a meeting in May, which I don't think they'll raise. If you look at the futures market, they're betting on a June rate hike of probability of over 40% right now.
Okay, so I guess we have to look at an investment implication for this. If we are in a Fed rate raising cycle, which is what we seem to be doing, they raise rates until something breaks. What are you doing to manage investments in the light of this?
Well, we're doing what we're always doing. We're taking money off the table. We've been increasing our short-term bond position. We're moving more into sort of defensive type stocks, and we'll be raising cash because they never ring the bell at the top. At some point, you'll see the economic numbers start to roll over, and you'll see the sequence of events that we've seen play out in the last couple of recessions and bear markets. The bond market will peak first, and I think we've seen that. The second thing will happen, the stock market will peak. And then finally, the third thing that will happen will be that the commodity markets will peak. So I expect to see that sequence play out, and we'll talk about that sequence in my special guest on the program next week, a special surprise guest that people haven't heard from in a long time. So we'll let the anticipation build for that. But he's one of my favorite technicians that I follow, and he's been very instrumental in innovative ways of looking at the market. We'll be talking more about that. But right now, John, we're gradually getting more defensive. We're building our short-term bond position. some cash, building in some defensive type stocks, because this is not going to take place overnight. You're not going to wake up one day and the market's going to be down 20-something%. It is something that will take place over time. And like I said, they never ring the bell at the top. And we never know when you get to that point where it's one interest rate too far. And we do know historically the old Edson Gould adage of three steps and a stumble, that third step, the third rate hike, is coming next week.
So what you're saying here is that they're probably not going to break with their historic track record, and they're going to raise rates until something breaks, which, of course, is something we will, I wasn't going to say look forward to, we'll monitor coming up next week as we round out the show. Anything else we're spying for the months ahead?
No, I would say the big thing is next week, the FOMC meeting, and Janet Yellen, the chair, will be holding a press conference afterwards. So we'll dissect everything. I think the most important thing to look at is what they do with the dot plot. If they remain or keep the dot plot as it currently stands, then I don't think there's a greater risk for the market, because the market has already priced in this rate hike, which is one of the reasons why it has not been doing well here. It's been kind of stumbling here in the last 2 weeks. And then, of course, John, March ends the first quarter of the year, so we're going to take a look at the economic numbers, which will be coming out in the month of April, and we get into Q1 earnings season. So any company that's going to miss their estimates are going to start releasing the dirty laundry here in the next couple of weeks. So those are two things that we're going to be watching closely. And of course, this is going to be 1 year where politics is going to drive so much of what's going to happen here in our markets as well as elsewhere, either through monetary policy or through legislation, whether it's the repeal of Obamacare, whether it's tax cuts, corporate tax cut reform, and infrastructure. All those items are big items that will play geopolitically and have an impact on the markets this year. So this is 1 year politics is going to have a major influence on the outcome of the markets. In the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.